Good evening. My name is Josh Wheeler. I'm the Associate Director of the Thomas Jefferson Center for the Protection of Free Expression. I'd like to thank you all for gambling that it wasn't going to rain and come out tonight. Before we get started, I'd just like to say the center is, we're the folks who were behind the First Amendment Monument. I want to apologize for its chalky veneer, however. It's because of the water restrictions, we're not able to clean it with a hose. We're using a bucket and water to save on water. And we're able to get most of the writing off, but the chalky veneer remained. So it's usually not this messy. But when we built this monument, it was never our intention just to have a chalkboard. It was always intended to serve another form of expression, verbal expression, through various events, programs, and such, using the podium aspect of it. And that's why we're here tonight. We're very pleased to present tonight's program. I think this is really democracy at its best, people being able to talk one-on-one with their elected representatives. And so I want to say thank you to our two delegates for being here beforehand, but I'll leave that to our moderator to introduce them. But it's my pleasure to introduce our moderator. If you don't know Jane Foy by face, you probably know her voice. Jane has, for a number of years, been the co-host of WNINA's morning show, where she makes talking and talking to a variety of people about a whole variety of issues just incredibly easy. She's just very, very good at putting people at ease and making them more, oftentimes sound more interesting than they really are. But so we couldn't ask for some a better moderator for tonight's program. So I would like now to turn it over to Ms. Jane Foy. Thank you.
Thank you, Josh. Thank you all. Of course, I don't have to pull out any wonderful radio talent to make our two guests tonight more interesting than they already are, because they are certainly two very, very interesting and dedicated public servants, and it's always my pleasure to have either David or Rob, or both at the same time, on the morning show, and always has been. To my immediate right, of course, is David Toscano, who has been in the General Assembly for one whole year. Two-ish. And a little bit longer than... Rob has been in a little bit longer than David. David is the representative in the 57th District, which is the city of Charlottesville and a whole big chunk of Albemarle County. And Rob's district is 58th and includes a piece of Albemarle County. And we forget that he also represents folks in Green, Orange, and Fluvanna, because we think of both of these gentlemen, we being in Charlottesville and Albemarle, as our David and our Rob. So you can imagine my surprise when I attended for the first time in my life a demolition derby in Green County and ran into Rob Bell. I don't know who was more surprised, seeing who, Rob or me, but he represents those folks as well as he represents us. So without too much further ado, we'll get the evening rolling. I'm going to man the mic, as it were, and it's got a big long tail on it. So if you have a question, please raise your hand. I will try to get to everybody in the time that we're here, and I'll come to you with the mic so you can use it so that David and Rob can hear your question. I think I'd like to start it off because this is the issue that is on everybody's mind and keeps making the front page of the newspapers, and that is, gentlemen, how did we get this these traffic fines? Let's talk about the legislation that has got a whole bunch of public outcry, everything from rescind it, make it go away. How did we, David, if you take the lead on this, how did we get this legislation that we have these in excess of type fines for traffic violations?
Well, thanks very much. Can you all hear me out there? You don't mind if I take my coat off? It's pretty hot. I'll just put it down here. Just to give you a little perspective on these, on the abusive driver fees, I brought along my portion of the bill that includes the fees. It is 68 lines out of a bill that's 2,592 lines. So in terms of the entire transportation package, it's a very small piece, but it has generated a lot of controversy. Now, why did we get here? How did we get here? Well, that's a long story, and it goes back to the first year I was in the General Assembly when a number of Republican delegates from Northern Virginia proposed this kind of arrangement in one single bill. And they did it, and I think Rob would probably agree with me, because they concluded that they thought their colleagues in the House of Delegates would never approve a tax increase to fund transportation, and so they wanted to put together their own package, primarily for Northern Virginia, but built on the notion of increasing fees on abusive drivers. That bill ultimately failed in the first session that I served in, but it was resurrected during an effort by, again, the House Republican leadership to come forward with a transportation bill that they thought could pass. That bill was called HB 3202, and it hit the House of Delegates floor rather quickly, even though that bill was about that thick. It included a whole host of things, including the abusive driver fees, which were buried in the bill. Everybody knew that that was there. Nobody should mislead you into thinking that they didn't know it was there, because it had been there for several years. 3202 passed the House of Delegates. I voted against that bill. It then went to the Senate and passed by an eyelash. It went to the governor, and then the governor went about amending the bill. He put forward 100 technical amendments just to make the bill work the way it was supposed to, and he did some minor changes to the abusive driver fees, primarily because of a concern that you could not enforce these fees against out-of-state drivers. That's why we got people are so angry. One reason why people are so angry is they feel that it's unfair that Virginia drivers should have to pay, but out-of-staters who commit the same offenses are omitted from having to pay. There are a whole host of other concerns that they have. My view on this abusive driver fee has always been it's bad policy, it's a bad way to raise transportation monies. The irony is that under the scenario that's been put forth by the House, it only would raise $68 million a year, which is about equivalent to a cent and a half increase on the gas tax, which is probably a better way to fund transportation than these abusive driver fees. That's a long-winded answer. That's my take on how we got there.
Rob, how would you like to pick up from there?
Well, I have a pretty significant difference in terms of how we got here, but I'm not sure how productive it is. And I remember last year's setting, everyone was very complimentary about how we didn't treat this as a partisan mud fight. So I will decline unless somebody asks about it, and I'll be happy to tell you. But I do think it's important to see what we do from here. And I think that regardless of how we got here, we have heard people say we never listen. I can say with absolute certainty we listen. when people shout loud enough, we certainly listen. And there's a clear consensus that the fees right now are a mistake. And so I think that the only question is there something here worth saving, or do we repeal the whole thing? And it might be worthwhile when you all are either telling us right after this or during your comments. The issues left would be, is there some reason, is it worth saving things like, and I'll put some ideas out for you, higher fees on drunk drivers. There's 26,000 drunk drivers a year. We could keep the fees for the drunk drivers. We could keep the fees for just the repeat drunk drivers. There's about 6,000 of them. We could keep the fees for repeat offense reckless drivers. Some people don't want it for any of reckless drivers. Some people say repeat offenses are enough. And it may be that there's a level of bad speed which is so high, 90, 100, pick some number, and it'd be interesting to hear what people think, where the fees are worth saving. I think that if we don't do that, in other words, if we don't save part of it, we'll just repeal the whole thing and start over. So those are my thoughts.
Well, when you're talking about sort of tweaking the existing bill now or leaving in some parts, like, as you just said,
right.
Would that also include that out-of-state driver?
No, I think that's a prerequisite to doing anything. And let's be clear, I don't think there's any realistic tweaking to do on this bill. I think you either overhaul it and keep some of it, or you get rid of the whole thing. I think it's repeal most or all of it is where we are today.
Now, does anybody, would anybody else like to start questioning of question for Rob or for David Toscano? Yes?
Then would not a, I'll ask Rob Bell, would not a gas tax make some sense if we do want to deal with the transportation problems, which I think everybody agrees need to be dealt with?
Okay. Well, I think that the amount of money is fairly modest, and I do think that the given the 2004 tax increase, which was the biggest increase in Virginia history, given the surpluses that were run up in the succeeding years, I would certainly want to see the money come out of the budget before I see it come out of an additional tax increase. Now that's sort of the, that you're starting to see why maybe some of these were seen as a compromise, but that would be my preference, would be we have a transportation trust fund. We have raided it repeatedly to spend money on other purposes. At a minimum, we should use that money first before we see if we need to add an additional tax increase on what Virginians already pay.
David, do you have a comment?
Well, when I first got to Richmond, I heard from a lot of folks throughout the state, a lot of business interests throughout the state, and they were telling us that based on their projections of road projects in the works, Virginia needed $1 billion more in sustainable, yearly, long-term sources of reliable revenue to get the job done. And that number has been scaled down and scaled down and scaled down. And this package, I think, is maybe about $500-600 million. And of course, it'd be my preference that we should try to find money out of other places before you raise taxes. I don't think you just raise taxes willy-nilly. But if you're looking for a long-term, sustainable source of revenue that flows directly into the transportation trust fund, you have to look, I think, at user fees, and that's the gas tax. 2 cents on the gas tax gives you about $100 million, which is a bit more than the abusive driver fees would give you. So, and that's not a huge increase in taxes. And I think one of the things about the debate that's been kind of interesting is that if people started to focus on the abusive driver fees, they started asking the question, well, you know, if we got to raise that kind of money, wouldn't it be better if we spread it across everybody who uses the roads, including people who drive through Virginia? And there are a lot of them. I think in excess of 20-25% of those people who are on interstates are actually people who don't live in Virginia. Why not give some of their money to help fund our roads?
I would think the drunk driver is the one who should have to pay more than anybody, because they jeopardize other people's lives and they're repetitive.
You want? I'm glad to comment on that. And this is one place where I think you and I probably agree. There is some data that indicates that repeat offenders create more havoc on the road and more congestion on the road. And to the extent that congestion is the problem, not just building more roads, if you can hit the repeat offender and deter that person from repeat offending, it will help solve some of these problems. I would be willing to look at increasing fines on drunk drivers, but I say fines. They would be penalties. The way it works now, they are fees, and ultimately, I guess, DMV would collect them. That was the reason fees were used, is that fees could go right into the transportation trust fund. If you collect fines, like traffic fines, they go into the literary fund for education. That's part of the reason why they came out as fees and not fines. That's sort of inside baseball, but it's an important pitch, shall we
say. Rob, could you elaborate on that a bit? Because I think that came as a shock to a lot of people, that the fees for traffic violations go into a literary fund, and that was a trail that kind of surprised people. And why do we still have it?
That was done before. Neither Dave nor I were there when that was done. It's actually in the state constitution, I understand, and so it's not something that can easily be changed. But right now, the traffic fines you pay for speeding tickets and running red lights and all the various fines, if you've ever had one, go into something called the literary fund, and it has forever. And I think that the basis was is that fines were never intended to raise revenue. Now, some localities might use them that way, but certainly it was never a state source of revenue. It was intended to make people obey the traffic laws. And so the place they were going was never seen as the primary concern of anyone. Now, I think that we should go back to that. I've come at it probably come to the other direction, but I certainly end up at the same place as Dave is, which is to the extent that these are being used as a revenue tool, a lot of the mischief that had people worried is because they are trying to be used as a revenue tool, not to enforce traffic safety. And so if you go through the list of offenses, there are offenses that most people would say are just not that big a deal in terms of traffic safety. So it includes reckless driving at 80+. It includes drunk driving third offense. It includes felony hit and run. Very serious traffic offenses that probably, if that had been all there was, and you had the in-state, out-of-state issue dealt with, probably would have been something that most people think, is a good idea. But you've got a couple of problems that are wrong with it. The way it's structured now, you have minor offenses that are included, and this would be where it might be too late to have a back and forth about this. We might just have to get rid of them and start over. But, you know, is driving 80 on 64 kind of bad, not so bad, or really bad? Because we can stop it. We can, if we keep these fines in place, we will stop speeding on 64. But that's at a very high cost. That means the poor people that get caught are going to pay a big, big fine. Maybe 80 is not where we want to cut it off. Maybe 90. Maybe 100. I mean, I was on 64 today driving back and forth from Henrico County. I saw several people driving at least at 80. I don't think I saw anybody doing really fast. But certainly if you drive that road a lot, you will see people driving at a very high rate of speed. And then you also have the bigger problem on 95 and 81 where it's terribly unsafe, especially for big trucks. And so we could, again, the question is going to be whether we try, I think, and salvage some of that, or whether we've reached a point where the public would rather us just get rid of them, start from scratch, start over, and maybe go through the other direction. In other words, start from zero and build up rather than start with the bill we have and subtract out.
Well, one question I have is, why do we have this literary fund? And I mean, why, if we have a fund for education, we have a separate literary fund. Why can't that all be put in one fund and then traffic fees go into a transportation fund? Or why are we diluting it?
I don't think there's any reason for that. That was, again, it wasn't intended as a revenue tool, and someone back in the day probably said, where do we want the money to go? Let's put it in education, just to make sure that, frankly, we don't fritter it away on other things. This is the first year that that's become a big issue, because I think that it's fair to say that the money being raised from these fines is big enough that people really care. Now, a lot of localities care. Localities can use traffic offenses through the local code so that, frankly, the money never goes to the state. It goes to the localities. I know that some localities, it's an important part of their budget, but it's not, in the state budget, has not been seen as a revenue, sort of revenue-producing item in the past.
Want to comment, Dave? Okay. Yes.
Isn't the larger problem the fact that the legislature doesn't have the courage to use the T word, to say, if you want to have services, you want to have infrastructure, you want to have bridges that don't collapse, we got to kick in. You have to raise taxes. But nobody wants to do that. So they thought, aha, we'll get it from speeders, and not thinking, or whatever, that traffic would do it. But isn't it? Doesn't this demonstrate a tremendous lack of grown-ups in the legislature?
David, you want to start?
She makes me want to cry.
I think even though Rob and I might disagree on some things, you know, we try to act grown up, at least when we have the discussions. I think it is, you know, there are some wide philosophical differences within the House of Delegates. And you sort of understand some of the reticence to raise taxes by rural legislators. You know, if you go across the mountain, you drive through some of the rural counties, and you rarely see a car on the road in the rural county, and at the same time, those folks are going to be asked to raise taxes on their constituents, and they say, well, why? We don't need any more roads in, for lack of a better word, Augusta County or Bath. You asked the question, how do you explain it? I'm trying to explain it. Now, for me, I think it is a commonwealth, and we do have an interest in trying to help people throughout the state with their various unique problems. Northern Virginia has huge problems, and people in Augusta County or other rural counties who don't think they ought to be helping fund roads being built in Northern Virginia ought to think again, because Northern Virginia is a huge economic engine. And if we choke Northern Virginia, we're going to choke a lot of the critical revenue that gets distributed in school divisions throughout this Commonwealth. It's hard sometimes to make that case to constituents in those areas. And I think since there's so many folks in the General Assembly who come from those areas, it's hard to get their vote on a tax increase. You know, that being said, I support an increase in the gas tax to help fund transportation. I think it's the best way to go. But I'm only one. Got to have a number of more like me to get something like that passed.
Rob, you want to give us your grown-up answer?
Oh, I don't know. I want to cry when I get fussed at. Ms. Jackwith, the fact is we are paying more. We're paying a lot more. And I've got the numbers, and I actually opened it at this page because this is a topic that often seems to come up. But when I was elected 6 years ago, which is either forever or just a blink, the state budget stood at $47 billion, is now at $74. Now, I've said this, and I think I'm right. If I had told you when I ran 6 years ago that I was going to vote for a budget that was $74 billion 6 years from now, first off, I would never have received the Republican nomination because they would have seen me as a big spender, and the people that want more spending would have carried me around on their shoulders and said that you're a hero. You'll never get that through the legislature. And here we are, and the budget has increased by that much, and I always say this, we're here 6 years ago, and we had roads and schools and prisons. We had a university that was in the top 25. We had all of these things. It wasn't like Virginia was Mississippi at the time. And I say that as a former resident of Mississippi. I'm not trying to cast aspersions. Since that time, we have increased the budget by this much. And so the roads say they need $1 billion more each year. Okay? Now, let's take them at their word. I don't know that that's right, but let's take that at their word. Out of, 74 to 47, we have that billion, 23 times over. Now, there is absolutely, just so everybody's clear, there's growth of population, there's growth by inflation. Those both should be taken out of any metric you're using to see how much the budget should be growing. But the budget growth, even leaving aside the big tax increase of 2004, has dwarfed inflation plus growth, inflation times growth. It's just going much faster. Now, I think you could say that Virginia is a state which is cheap, and you just think it should be a less cheap state. And I think that's a legitimate philosophical concern. And if you think Virginia should raise taxes more and spend more, then there's nothing wrong with that position. And probably, if not a majority of the legislature, certainly a large minority believe that. I don't agree. I think that we should be able to get by on the increases we've had so far. And, I mean, it's clear at this point, projecting conservatively, that we will have doubled the budget in my 10 years that I'm there if I happen to stay for 4 more years. We're certainly on target for that level of aggregate growth. And so, should we spend some of that money on roads? Sure. I think absolutely. Some of that increase in the budget should go to roads, but it's not. I don't feel comfortable going back to the people who are already paying that much more money, because that money comes from us already, and saying, by the way, in addition to the tax increases of 2004, we now think you should have this additional tax increase. So I understand where you're coming from, and you've written me articulately about this before. Thank you.
Any other questions? Yes, sir.
There are federally funded groups that are promoting an abstinence-only curriculum to replace real sex education in our schools. What is your position on abstinence-only curriculum, and what will you do at the state level to support real sex education in our schools?
I'm not sure I heard the whole question. Was it
abstinence-only education?
There's a move to have abstinence-only education, sex education in public schools.
Right. How
do you feel about that? Am I paraphrasing you correctly, or how would you feel about having actual curricula, sex education, real reality sex education in public schools?
I favor real reality sex education in public schools, and I think abstinence-only curriculum is a recipe for disaster. Who doesn't support abstinence? At the same time, Let us get real. Let's have medically sound and correct sex education in the schools, and at the appropriate level, age appropriate. So I don't support the efforts to make it abstinence only in school divisions across the Commonwealth.
Rob?
I think that, let me say this, I certainly favor sex education programs that prioritize that. Now, I understand that may not be I know someone in the audience I won't point her out, but we've had a nice discussion about this very topic. But I do think that as currently constructed, we do an awful lot through the local levels, and I think that this may or may not be something you'd like to see decided at the local levels. As currently created, we have significant variations in how it is handled across the Commonwealth. Now, the alternative would be to have us set it in Richmond, but I can assure everyone here that if we set it in Richmond, neither Greene County nor the city of Charlottesville will be delighted, because it will be somewhere between, just to show how close, or let's say Madison County is one step further out, because they handle it very differently, and I think that obviously you'll have a compromise between the two, but I would prefer to see it done as it is currently done at the local level. Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Speaking of revenue, we spend a great deal of money on the criminal justice system, including building prisons. And do you feel if that money was appropriated to deal with education, particularly of people, young people, in particular African Americans in this state, that money would be a better investment? You would have less money. I mean, you would have more money to do other things with, because people would be more productive being out of prison than in prison with the education and with opportunity.
Well, you know, a few minutes ago, Rob talked about the budget and the expansion of the budget. I mean, if you look at what happened in the 1980s, especially in the latter part of that decade, one of the major budget drivers was prison construction and prisons. That has slowed a little bit because a lot of the prisons that were on the line to be constructed have been constructed, and now we're filling them up. And the cost of filling them up is very expensive, and it shows up as a budget item every year. You know, as a general philosophy, you know, I think we got to do two things. One is the most serious criminals have to be put away for long periods of time so they don't come back and commit other serious crimes. But we have to invest a lot in young people so they're not at risk of going into the prison population at an early age, and then they eventually do come out, and then they're in a middle age, they continue to commit crimes, and they're back in. So as a philosophical position, I'd like to be spending more at the younger ages. I'm also concerned about the criminalization of so many of our teenagers. I think I've got concerns about too many youngsters being tried as adults. There is a procedure in Virginia that people need to go through in order to try a youngster as an adult. But I have some concerns that if you try them as an adult too early and they end up in the adult prison population, they're going to be hardened and they're going to be coming out at age 35 and they're going to be committing crimes when they get out.
Both of our delegates are members of the Courts of Justice Committee, correct?
Right. Yes, ma'am.
You are. Yeah. Rob, do you want to comment on the penal system?
Well, I mean, I think that at a high level of philosophy, I hope we would all agree that if you could say we'll spend the $20,000 on a person that we're going to put in for the prison on school, rehabilitation, counseling, training, something else to keep them out of prison, even if it were dollar for dollar, I hope we all would do it. I have to say, though, I don't want to mislead you, and we've talked numerous times about this very topic, that I am skeptical that we can magically make that happen, and I believe that at the point when someone commits a crime, especially a violent crime, I lose my sort of in my weighing of the equities in terms of letting them fulfill themselves, be more successful, be more effective, is weighed against the impact they're having on the community. And I certainly weigh those in a way that I think that if they cannot comport themselves in a way that is safe, I have no trouble taking them off the streets and keeping them someplace where they can't hurt somebody for as long as it takes for them to stop doing that. So I don't want to mislead anyone about, I'm a former prosecutor. I think most of you know that I've been working on these laws for a long time, and I'm aware that while I think at a philosophical level we would all agree to do what you're describing, I don't think in practice I've seen the impacts you're talking about. Thank you.
Have they made any difference in the drug penalties? Like some people just were found once with some, the marijuana, and they wind up in jail. Have they thought that out a little bit more and not lock people up on a small amount?
I have to say that in there are two sets of laws. The federal laws made up by Congress in Washington and the state laws made by Dave and I down in Richmond. Most of the examples that people talk about with regards to drug laws are the federal laws. In other words, there aren't many people in Virginia. I remember the local prosecutor said he could not recall someone going to jail for any length of time for marijuana in his tenure. It's just it's not something that is prosecuted. When it's prosecuted, it's not prosecuted very effectively. That if the first offense marijuana, it can actually be taken off your record. The second offense, you get counseling. Now, if you are a dealer, if you are a distributor, if you're someone who is providing it to other people, then even in the state system, you can get a significant sentence. And it absolutely is true that people, especially those dealing cocaine, get significant sentences in the state system. Now, it is different for drugs like methamphetamine, heroin, and cocaine. Now, those are treated as felonies even for simple possession. And so even if you are, now it would typically be a repeat offender before you would have a significant prison sentence, but at least in the state system, that's where the longer sentences arise. Now, when George Allen abolished parole, they set up something called the Sentencing Commission. And one of the goals of the Sentencing Commission was to the extent you have so many prison beds in the Commonwealth, and I forget the number, it's 27,000, there's a certain number of prison beds in the Commonwealth, you want to have as many of those beds filled with violent offenders as possible. And so what you've seen since 1994 has been a shift in sentences from longer sentences to those offenders, and then the outcome of the sentencing guidelines has been to push down the sentences for everyone else. So the sentences, for instance, for stealing, I would suspect, I don't have a study in front of me, but I'll bet are significantly lower than they were in 1994 because those bed spaces have to come from somewhere. But the sentences for the armed robbers, murderers, rapists, the violent felons are much longer than they were a few years ago.
Okay. You had a question, sir?
What do you think is the state role regarding global warming, and what is the state of Virginia currently engaged upon in terms of policy in that area?
David, would you like to start?
Sure. Well, there was an attempt to pass an omnibus energy bill 2 years ago, and it wasn't very successful. There was a resolution to study global warming introduced in the House of Delegates this session,
and
Adam Eben out of Arlington, and it didn't get out of committee, I don't think. So I don't know what that tells you. But for my way of thinking, I think we got to do a lot more to address the whole issue of energy in the Commonwealth of Virginia. Every way from which we build buildings to things that we can do at administrative levels to encourage conservation in state buildings. I've got some ideas for some legislation for providing incentives for people who create energy conserve. And houses that conserve more energy than the typical house. There are other things that we need to be doing. I've got some ideas about school buses. I've got some ideas about some increased funding for transit and rail. One of the good things about the transportation package that people have lost in this whole debate about abusive driver fees is there's more money for transit and rail in this transportation plan than I think any transportation plan that's ever been passed by the House of Delegates in the Senate. So that was one good thing. And that was actually one of the reasons why I voted for the final passage when it came to the House floor back in the veto session. So I guess the answer to your question, we got to do a lot more. There are only certain things we can do in Virginia. A lot has to happen at the federal level. But those certain things that we can do in Virginia, we ought to start doing.
Rob, do you want to add a little environmental comment, please?
Well, I think that Dave's right that we're not the federal government. There are going to be limitations on our ability, especially in places like Northern Virginia, where you have interstate travel being a significant part of the traffic and sort of the pollution creation. But we can do a lot better job of being an example. Even in our area, I have in my district two power plants. I've got Bremo Bluff down in Flavanna, and I've got Tenaska also in Flavanna. Lake Anna is just a lake away from all of us, and that raises, I think, thought-provoking questions about the sources of power and what we're going to do. I know that nuclear power raises concerns for many people. On the other hand, I've heard some prior opponents of nuclear power speak recently that it's something they think ought to at least be on the table for consideration in terms of how we generate the electricity that we need after conservation measures are put in.
Maybe while I'm back here.
I'm going to change the topic again. Given legislation in recent years to define when life begins, I'm concerned that this would interfere with access to birth control, and I'd like to hear from each of you where you stand on access to birth control.
I think we should encourage it as much as possible. I support access to emergency contraception. I don't think there's much more to say. My position's been pretty clear. I think I've voted for every pro-choice measure that's come down the pike in the General Assembly and tried to oppose things that would cut off people's constitutional right of reproductive choice.
There was a bill this year that attempted to define it in the way you describe. I voted against that bill. And I think that the technology is driving some decisions that perhaps we were not forced to make 20 years ago or even 10 years ago. And what I mean is that the in vitro fertilization process, which has become a more accepted part of how families have children, is obviously addresses or raises some of these very issues that you're talking about. As we have looked at contraception, it used to be the notion that it is contraception. We've now reached a point where our technology can separate out the fertilization from the implantation from the growth, things that used to just be treated as a single entity, and we're having to sort of separate out what are the ethical and moral issues, if any, involving those. So I did vote against that bill. Well, I voted against that bill in part because I thought that it would raise concerns about in vitro fertilization and the birth control pill, which have a mechanism of a mechanism of action that apply after fertilization. The birth control pill does have a mechanism of action that does that, and so one of the concerns would be that the birth control pill itself might be, now there's arguably a Supreme Court case that would preclude any action that would do that, but in any case, that's what the bill would have done. And then in addition, with regards to in vitro, it's the same fertilization issues and timing issues that are coming to fore, but that's one of the reasons I voted against that bill.
Jerry Kilgore and Senator Creed Deeds have both spoken at Charlottesville Drug Court graduation ceremonies and praised the program as being effective at a third or less the cost of incarceration with a much higher rate of non-recidivism. Is this something that should be expanded in Virginia?
I've seen the results of the drug court. I've been to a number of the graduations. They're very inspiring. It's not a total success. There are some people who fall back. But the experience after 10 years of the drug court in Charlottesville suggests to me that if you put the right personnel in place and you've got the right court personnel there as well, it can have a tremendous impact on people's lives at much lower costs than housing them in a prison. So I think we should try to expand it more throughout the Commonwealth, and there are more jurisdictions that are putting it in place.
I would encourage everybody to go to drug court. I would also encourage you to read the paperwork behind it. And I think that this is I've been skeptical or concerned about drug courts for a long time, and I think that this is one where I've come to conclude that most people don't agree with me, and that's okay. It wouldn't be the first time that I'm not in the majority position. But my biggest concern is just that I don't believe this has to be done by the judge. The idea that you should have a therapeutic model to approach nonviolent drug users, what we used to call peaceful junkies, the people that are primarily abusing themselves in terms of the drug process, is not a bad one. And I think it's something that different jurisdictions have done in different ways. In some places, it's done through the probation office, and I think that's an entirely appropriate way to deal with people whose primary problem is drug addiction. They're not attacking other people. They're not robbing people at gunpoint. They're not breaking into houses. Their primary problem is that they're addicted to crack. The concern would be that you take a significant amount of court time from the judge when you do this, and this is maybe not be obvious to non-lawyers, but just so we're clear, there's one person through whom everything in a court system has to flow. Every single case, appeal, motion, brief, pleading, every argument, every question by the bailiff goes through one person, and that's the judge. And the judge has one limited asset that he needs more of, and that's time. And I think that there's nothing wrong with taking a therapeutic model to this, but I would want to see a couple things done. At first, I'd want to see that we make real efforts to limit the judge's time just so that it doesn't take away from all the other things the judge has to do. For instance, the probation officer could be the first whack, and if of the people that doesn't work, you could maybe graduate them to a drug court run by the judge. The second is you need to be careful about mission creep. This system, our local drug court law, was founded on the premise that it would apply only to non-violent drug users. And if you go look at the paperwork right now, you will find people that were never expected to be part of the drug court system. And then the third is I would feel better about it if we had a double or nothing approach to this. What I mean is right now everyone gets a shot at drug court, and if they fail, there's no impact. And I would like to see us take a more affirmative approach to say to the drug user, if you want to take advantage of this system, we will let you. But understand there are costs to this. It's not automatic. We want you to make a real commitment. We're not just try it five times before you wash out. So those are my concerns about it. I can assure everyone it's a minority position. If you think I'm foolish on this, that appears to be where everyone else is. And so the impact of my concerns on policy are muted at best.
Yes, sir.
I wonder if y'all could talk a little bit about growth issues. Specifically, do you think that localities have enough tools to deal with growth? Do you think they need additional tools from the state legislature? And if they do, what sort of tools might they need?
I don't mind starting if you...
Go ahead.
The last two or three years, we have sort of steadily given new things to the localities to see how they turn out, and I sort of run through them quickly. Well, let me even back up further. The state has started purchasing conservation easements at a pretty good clip, so that's sort of at the state level. That's not directly addressing your question about the localities. We have, in the last 2 years, tried, and I have to say we haven't seen the impacts of this yet, but something they call transferable development rights. And I know Dave had a bill, and I'll let him talk about his bill, but the basic idea of a TDR would be a locality has so many developable lots, we want them to go to the right part of the county, in Albemarle County's instance. And so the way you do that is, the way to do it in a voluntary way at least, is you say to the people in the outlying areas, we will let you transfer your development to the development area. It's a way to do it without doing it through mandates, which is the other way to do it is just say, I'm sorry, you can't develop your property. The third would be impact fees. The bill that was just passed, as one of the many things in this omnibus transportation bill that people do like, is there are impact fee provisions in it that would allow localities to set up an impact fee system. Right now they use something called proffers. Not all localities have it. Proffers are seen by many as unfair because some people pay a lot, some people pay a little, some people are grandfathered in and don't end up paying much at all. An impact fee would be a more even-handed way of applying those same costs. So those are some of the, I think, tools that have come down. And impact fees just happened this last, it went into effect on July 1, so nobody knows yet how that new statute will be applied in the field, but that just came out.
Yeah, my history is in local government, so I generally support the idea of giving local governments more authority to address issues like development. It is true that over the last few years, the state has been giving more and more authority to local governments, and it remains to be seen how it's all going to turn out. I think we do need to give it some time to assess how it's going to turn out. You can control development in a number of ways, but they pretty much run the gamut from regulation to let the market work. And we're trying both kinds of approaches now. The acquisition of easements, land preservation easements and tax credits given to people who put land in the easements, it's an effort really, I think, to provide an incentive for the market to work. That has been a tremendously successful program in places like Albemarle County. In fact, Albemarle is either second or first among all the counties that use it. And that discourages a lot of development. Both Delegate Bell and myself supported that program very strongly, and some of our colleagues were fairly critical of how strongly we supported it. Then on the other side, you've got regulation, where you say to the localities, you give them the ability to impose an impact fee that might collect, might require the developer to contribute a sum of money to provide for transportation improvements, infrastructure. Albemarle hasn't adopted an impact fee ordinance yet, coming out of this last session's bill. There have been a couple of counties that have, but it's not clear what impact that's had. My concern has always been, well, what does this ordinance look like, and is it going to work for Albemarle County? So I'd like to see what they're going to come up with. Rob mentioned a bill that I had having to do with transfer of development rights. That bill will allow cities to take the development rights that otherwise would be used in counties, as long as they're adjacent, which would be a great idea for a place like Charlottesville and Albemarle to work together, where in Charlottesville you might want more dense development and the county might not want so much development. You transfer the development right into the city. There are other places in the Commonwealth where this might work. Delegate Bell had a bill that was a very creative bill that would have set up a market for the transfer of development rights. And I think it's probably fair to say that we need to work on that a little bit more. But the concept, again, is to help the market work to control where development goes and channel it in the right places. So we're just going to have to see over the next couple sessions what localities do and what impact it has.
Let me just real quick on that one point, just so everybody understands. The TDR program right now, the problem is if you want to use it, you have to find somebody at that very same instant who wants to give up his transfer development, right? And while they might be able to post it on a place like eBay or Craigslist, it's not a very efficient way for someone that's trying to build houses. And the idea was we need to make it severable. So one person, Dave is a speculator, investor, call him what you will. He says, I will go collect 20 or 30 of these, and then I will find a way to use them or turn it around. Just some way that you can sever them off of the land. And the problem was, and you'll see at the moment, it shows how we're not as smart as we like to think we are. The problem is taxes. The moment you sever it, someone has to pay the tax because Bob Gibson's property, which was worth $100,000, now is worth $10,000. That $90,000 difference is in that development, right, that's now held in some strange piece of paper in a safe in some, you know, collator's office. And we actually didn't think of that. That was just to show how we all got into the committee, and I thought this was such an obvious thing. We need to make them severable so that if people want to start to make these things work, they can. And somebody stood up and said, well, who's going to pay the taxes on that? And we all kind of looked away and pretended it was somebody else's bill. And finally, we put it off for a year to try and figure that out. And I'm sure there's a way you can probably make the collator pay the taxes. He's the one who's doing the work. You wouldn't want him. But in any case, someone has to pay the taxes on the land since the property value is now split between two owners.
Sir, did you have a question?
Last year there was a bill. Last year there was a bill sponsored by the Housing Committee to add source of income as a protected class, and it kind of died in committee. I was just wondering if anybody knows why, or is that going to be reintroduced next year? And I think the purpose behind that was for folks who have a Section 8 voucher, essentially. As it stands right now, you get a Section 8 voucher, yet you can't use it because there are all these places that are listed in the newspaper that say, we'll take anybody except those who have a Section 8 voucher.
I don't know about that bill. I mean, there are 3,000 bills that are introduced every year. We only sit on a couple of committees, and it's quite possible a bill will be heard in a committee and die in committee, and we've never even heard about it. And I don't know about that bill. I can try to check, but I haven't heard about it.
I'm afraid I'm in the same boat. One of the problems of us sharing committees is we have, I'd like to think, some deep expertise on, unfortunately, the same narrow trenches of issues. And we're both on courts, and I'm afraid I don't know much about that bill either. I apologize.
They're very accessible by email, though. I vouch for that.
But, contact us. We'll try to dig it up and tell you what happened to it at the very least.
Somebody has got to ask them about these budget cuts now. Come on, folks.
I wanted to know if there was any money allocated for checking the safety of bridges.
Good question.
I know that it's part of the VDOT budget. I assume you mean if we made some special changes as a result of the bridge in Minnesota?
Yes. Well, we check the bridges frequently.
You best believe they were out there checking those a lot of bridges after this. They didn't communicate with our offices, but you best believe they were out there.
And in all seriousness, if there is a bridge that you are particularly concerned about, I'd be happy to, if you're my constituent, please let me know, and I'll find out the status of any certain bridges that you use, and I'm sure Dave would do the same. Okay.
Josh, did you have a question?
In knowing each of your opinion as to what is the most pressing issue facing the state that you can deal with the, in the legislature that perhaps we're not dealing with yet.
Wait, that was two questions, right?
Well, that's all right. He's the host. He gets to ask too.
I don't mind going in.
You want to go?
Yeah. This is... Pressing is a good adjective because it indicates some measure of something that's sort of timely and right before us. And so whether this is the biggest problem, I don't know, but it's certainly a big one, and it's one we're looking at, and that's the mental health component of delivery of care through the state. And it's no secret the genesis of this has sort of been percolating, and I've had bills and Dave's had bills that address itty-bitty parts of it, but the tragedy at Virginia Tech, I think, is creating some interest in looking at the system as a whole. You have a couple of large task forces working their way through. The Supreme Court has one. Governor Kane appointed Colonel Massengill to do one specific to Virginia Tech, and we're looking forward to see what their recommendations are. I think that there will be, to get back to the gentleman's questions about sort of root causes and big picture, and then my response about small answers and some small solutions, I think we're probably going to want to look at both. I think you're going to see some efforts to look at the entire mental health delivery system, and then at the same time, some efforts to address what went wrong at Tech. And those are not independent, but I do think that we're not going to just fix the big picture. We're probably not just going to fix some of these independent problems. And I sit on a couple of the committees, and so I've been privy to some of the things you've been reading summaries of in the paper about the specific sequence of events at Tech, just to pick the one I know more about. And it's clear that there were... I agree with the parents who say that we should not whitewash this. We shouldn't pretend that no mistakes were made and that everything is fine and we can just do what we were doing before just a little better and everything will be great. I think that what this was an instance where the victim was not simply the mentally ill person, because I think that history would say that usually the mentally ill person disappears, kills himself, moves away, gets sick, dies under an underpass. The reason this has caught everyone's attention is because, of course, the casualties went further than just the mentally ill person, but I think this is an opportunity to look at the delivery of care and see where people are slipping between the cracks, because I think it's pretty clear that that's what Cho did.
I agree that the most pressing issue in the next General Assembly is going to be this one. I think there are probably going to be 100 bills introduced on this topic. There are some real budgetary issues, Jane.
Thank you.
Budgetary issues in light of the way the economy is turned down and it's generating lesser amounts of a surplus than one would have expected, and therefore gives us less flexibility on how we approach the money side. It's not all about money. There are things that we can do to change the mental health system that won't cost appreciable amounts of money. At the same time, we will have to invest some money. Right now, Virginia is 30th among the states in mental health spending, and I think you're going to see some efforts to remedy that particular situation.
Now, is it true that the governor is looking at right across the board 5% cut in each state department?
Well, it's more complex than that, because I believe he said that education is off the table. Right now he's focusing on asking for agencies to come up with possible 5% cuts, and he's not making them yet. I think there has been a 5% across the board cut in non-state agencies. So, for example, Lewis and Clark Exploratory Center, they got a big grant last year. I think that would probably be cut by 5%. Another one here that there are a couple in this area. Wolf Trap that gets $900,000 a year or whatever from the state. Is that what it is?
An even million. Yeah.
An even million now. They'll probably have to cut their budget 5%. But it's very much up in the air because, the projections are down, but we haven't gotten all the revenue in yet. So the governor's being prudent. We've seen this before. This is not a recession. This is an adjustment. and we want to plan for the future.
The colleges and universities are not going to have to look.
They're going to
have to
look.
You said they were off the table.
No, I'm talking about K through 12.
Oh, okay.
I'm sorry. The higher educational institutions are on the table very much, and the universities and colleges are working to find their 5% if they have to cut.
All right. Rob, where do you see some cuts being made?
Oh, we'll have to see. And let me just, I think everyone knows this, but cuts are not cuts. It's just a decrease in the rate of growth, and that's a cliche to say, but the Richmond Times-Dispatch did a nice article that said that the great shortfall is the result of only 4.9% growth this year. So, I mean, that's what it is less than the 6.2% growth that we were projecting, but it is not by any means true that we are cutting the amount of money that they're going to receive. Now, there will be some that actually do get actual cuts, and presumably that'll be because the conclusion has been that they're not at good places for us to spend money, but it's not true by any means that the overall state budget is going to decrease this year.
So you're saying that the rate of spending is really what is slowing down. It's
yes,
not
ma'am.
It's not cuts necessarily. So maybe we won't reach that plateau that you were threatening to reach if you stayed in office for 10 years.
I would bet my life that we will reach the plateau. I was being very conservative with my numbers. Yes, ma'am.
Anyone else have any questions? Well, actually, that's a good thing because I think the city is out of tape. Had a little budget cut,
you
tape just cut 5% of the tape, which makes us 10 minutes over our closing remarks. Thank you all for coming. Really appreciate it. I've seen some of you have been here before, and it's wonderful to know that you have the interest to show up and ask your questions. And you can always listen to us on the morning show on WINA from 6 to 10, and probably once a month or more, one of these two gentlemen will be on the show. I do want to also express gratitude, I think, from everybody that both Rob and David went to Mississippi? Yes.
No, Rob went.
Rob went to Mississippi. And we want to express gratitude. He went and saw off the Virginia National Guard who headed off to Iraq. And that was, we're going to talk to Rob tomorrow morning on the show about that, along with some folks from Blue Star Families who are the support group for the deployed in our area. So I'm interested to see how his trip went. And David, don't be a stranger.
Never.
Thank you all.
Thank you all for coming. Seriously, thank you very much.